Anyway, so I'll go around and say hi, and starting with Linda R. Mark, Bob K, Joan, Rosemary, Sam, Shoketsu, Marv, Pat, Alice, John, Phil, Etsido, Chris, Randy, Sarah, Paulette, Michael, Kaisa, and Ruth Ann. Wow, a number of people outdoors today. It's a little chilly here. I guess it's all relative compared to has been recently. All right, let's see. In terms of announcements, June 27th, Sunday, June 27th, is our Jukai ceremony. It looks like at this point there will be 7 people receiving the precepts, and that ceremony will take place when the Dharma talk ordinarily would be. And 3 people will be present here in person, and 4 people will be receiving the precepts from afar. As far away, I think Brazil is the farthest. Let's see. And then, oh yeah, August retreat, 23rd to the 28th, and it will have an online and an in-person option. And it looks tentatively like, so first of all, I am going on a sabbatical for the month of July. So I am planning to, everything will proceed as usual, but I will be arranging for visitors to be coming and giving the Dharma talks. I already have one scheduled for the 11th of July, I think. Ryushin has been here before. And otherwise, I'll be getting senior students to lead classes and stuff like that. So stay tuned. And yeah, so things will still be available. But, you know, if you want to go on sabbatical for the month of July too, you can. And then beginning in August, so this is all like tentative, right? And given COVID, you know, you make your plans, but we'll see. But tentatively, we're planning to open our Zendo at the beginning of August. And, you know, chances are we will remain socially distanced and masked and asking people to please be vaccinated. And I think we'll probably be a sign up as well, just because, you know, we'll have a maximum number in the Zendo of 19, I believe. So chances are we won't go over that, but like people will need to register ahead of time. And we will get everything set up so that if we will cast Zoom from the Zendo. So we'll be, I just, instead of being in my backyard Zendo shed, I'll be at the Zendo. For those of you participating from afar, it won't change too much. But I'm imagining there will be little shifts in things, right? Little awkwardnesses while changes are happening. And I'm, you know, myself and the board are very open to, you know, questions and comments and suggestions. And if you're curious at all, I think one of the features of our hybrid situation will be that just as there's, you know, when you log on in the morning, there's somebody called a guest master and they greet people as they come on. So we'll definitely have that. but also like that role might be expanded to a Zoom host. So it's somebody who is on Zoom, not somebody who's in the Zendo. Well, there'll be somebody in the Zendo who has to like do the interface, right? But there should be somebody hosting on Zoom to really pay attention to the Zoom participants and say hi and, you know, create the breakout rooms and whatever, so that it's not, you don't get a sense that like the Zoom people are kind of just witnessing from afar. So those of you who do participate regularly by Zoom, you know, that's definitely a role that you can step forward to do as well. So any questions or other things that I should announce? All right, so I recommend, I mean, when I'm giving the talk, I hesitate to say, put it on speaker view so you see my big old face. But I do want to just say, I recommend that when someone is leading a class or giving a talk, that you put it on speaker view. Just then I don't know, for me anyway, it helps me focus. Rather than just like, because on Zoom, inevitably, if you're looking at a whole bunch of people, there's movement and there's people, and you know, it's a little easier to just kind of relax and listen. So that kind of view you can change on computers. It's in the upper right corner, and you can change your view to speaker view, or gallery view is where you see everybody. I'm going to leave it on gallery view so I can look at all of you. All right, so this talk, calling the profound and difficult practice of putting everything down. So, lately, as I think some of you have heard in various check-ins that I've done, I've been struggling a bit with my own practice and trying to examine why. You know, what's going on? What are the obstacles? What's the lack of focus or inspiration about. And what I've found, and it's typical for me, and it's probably difficult for many of you, is an unwillingness to put everything down during Zazen. And I would say that Zazen is the primary time for this practice of putting everything down. But it can also be done, you know, as Dogen says, it's not limited to sitting or lying down, right? So it's also can be something that we do momentarily throughout the day with mindfulness, or we might do it for a period while we're doing an activity. We put everything else aside. So it's not just limited to our Zazen, but our Zazen is really where we make an effort at this kind of practice. So what is putting everything down? If you participate on Tuesday evenings, outside of our precept study time of year, where we just recite the precept booklet, and some people complain like, "Wow, we'd recite it every Tuesday when we're studying the precepts." And I want to say, like, at Dharmarain, where I studied, we recite Dogen's Fukan Zazengi. That is it. For when our Wednesday evening practice, for evening practice, that's what you recite, period. So at least I mix it up a little bit, right? On other times of the year. So this is from Dogen's Fukan Zazengi. So what we tend to read on Tuesdays is instructions about Zazen. And Dogen says, put aside the intellectual habit of investigating words and chasing phrases. And learn to take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. Put aside all involvements and suspend all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not judge true or false. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. And Keizan in Zazen Yojenki says, put aside all affairs and let go of all associations. Do nothing at all. If you want to eliminate delusive thoughts, you should cease to discriminate between good and evil. Give up all affairs with which you are involved. Do not occupy your mind with any concerns or become physically engaged in any activity. And then finally, from Faith and Mind by Chan Master Sung San. The supreme way is not difficult if only you do not pick and choose. Neither love nor hate, and you will clearly understand. Be off by a hair, and you are as far from it as heaven from earth. If you want the way to appear, be neither for nor against. For and against opposing each other, this is the mind's disease. So in our Zazen, our meditation, if we don't do specifically Zazen, we physically put everything aside at the very least. So it's good to remember that at least we're doing that, right? Even if our Zazen is full of thinking and whatever, we are at least physically, technically setting everything aside. As Kazan says, do not become physically engaged in any activity. So even that is important. But obviously to do Zazen wholeheartedly, to open ourselves up more fully to the joys and benefits of it, we want to put down everything mentally and emotionally as well. We want to do this with all parts of our being. So Kazan says other activities are like being outside of the gate. Zazen alone brings everything to rest and flowing freely reaches everywhere. So Zazen is like returning home and sitting in peace. So to sit in peace, we have to set aside, put down everything for the duration of our Zazen. But what does this really mean? It's not that we don't experience any thoughts or emotions or concerns while sitting. We really can't control that very much anyway, and it doesn't, ultimately, it doesn't actually matter all that much. What matters is what we choose to do. Whenever we have a moment of choice, what do we choose to do? What is our volitional activity while sitting there? Thoughts come into the mind, but then what do we choose to do when we become aware of that? When we've been caught up thinking, worrying, planning, fantasizing, random lazy mind wandering, what do we do? So we don't judge or react or try to stop the thoughts. That's just indulging in another kind of thought, a thought about how meditation should be and good thoughts and bad thoughts. And it's more thinking, really. So what I love is Uchiyama Roshi's, we open the hand of thought. So this metaphor makes it clear that what we're doing is, it's not we're wrestling with our mind and regaining control. We're letting go. If we're caught up mentally in involvements and affairs, contemplating good and bad, right and wrong, trying to figure things out, we have willfully, closed the hand of thought. We've grasped those thoughts. So the good news is that, we can let go. If we've grasped it, we can let go, in theory anyway. But what I want to argue today, and I doubt I'm the only one, is we don't want to put things down. We don't want to let them go. Or more accurately, part of us does. Part of us has experienced benefits from meditation before. And we know, it'd probably be a good thing to let this go. Or we're curious about it and we want to follow the recommendations of others who say, hey, this would be a really good thing to do. So part of us wants to do it, but parts of us resist for many, many, many reasons, many of which have to do with, good things, morality, responsibility, compassion, love for others. So In that context, in the context of our lives, cease to discriminate between good and evil? You know, what about morality? What about our lives and our choices? Cease to discriminate. If you give up your ability to tell between good and evil, what is that about? What is the good of a spiritual path where you don't discriminate between good and evil, harmful and helpful? Do not judge true or false. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Are you crazy? How would we survive in this world if we didn't have our wits about us, if we didn't try to make smart decisions, if we didn't take care of ourselves and our families? Give up all affairs with which you are involved. Well, that sounds fine and good, I guess. What about those affairs? Like, you don't have any choice. You're involved in them. You're neck deep in them. There are responsibilities. There's troubles. There's health issues. There's stuff like that that, like, put it aside? How do you just put it aside? Is that really even an option? If you want the way to appear, be neither for nor against. So is this passivity? Is this a lack of compassion? What about moral responsibility? Neither love nor hate, and you will clearly understand. Really? Give up love? If that's the price of having some sense of peace, I don't think most of us would be willing to pay it. So I suspect most of us only half-heartedly let go during Zazen. Kind of open the hand of thought mostly, but maybe kind of, you know, hold on to a thread. Or maybe we put it down, put something down, but we put it right next to us so we can pick it back up again pretty easily. We tell ourselves we should put it down, but another part of it is like, are you crazy? I can't put this down. So we might let go for a moment, but then pick up our concerns right away again. Out of fascination, excitement, worry, outrage. I mean, it's not all negative, right? Some of it is just like passion and curiosity and love. So we pick these things back up. So the thing is, in Zazen, and at these other times when we want to just, you might say, return to zero, if we really want to fully engage this practice, I would say, you can disagree with me if you want, that we need to put things down in that moment as if we're never going to pick them up again. That's the degree of letting go that our Zen ancestors are recommending. And I would say that it's not necessary to grasp this, and probably impossible to grasp this philosophically. We know from our experience the different degrees of letting go. So we might consciously just try to put something out of our mind for a while. We might try to embrace don't know mind for a while. Well, you know, that's all out of my control. We'll see what happens. But it's very different when we really let go. And sometimes we manage to do this in Zazen or through practice, but sometimes it's life circumstances which bring us face to face with the futility of our effort to hold on to things, or the changeability of our most cherished beliefs and opinions, or we recognize the illusions on which we've based so many of our decisions. When we really put something down or have it ripped from our grasp by life, if we really put something down with the same attitude we might have as if we were never picking it up again, there's a radical quality to our experience. And sometimes it's scary or disorienting when we open the hand of thought and fully release something, that we see as being essential to our life, it calls into question every other thing we're holding on to. What if it's all a house of cards? Who are we? How will we orient ourselves? How will we know right from wrong or make good decisions? So, as an example, I believe we are on the brink of climate catastrophe that will plunge our world into misery and chaos. I believe we all have a moral imperative to take radical action to minimize and mitigate the breakdown of Earth's natural life support systems. How can I put that down during Zazen? It's not even just about my life. It's about like life. It's about the, you know, there are no, without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. Put it down? How do you put down a terminal diagnosis for yourself or a loved one? If your life is an overwhelming mess of competing responsibilities, if others depend on you for their well-being, how can you put such things down? And if the greatest joys in your life involve family or study or creativity, why should you put such things down? If you witness injustice or cruelty, are you supposed to put that down? Isn't that selfish and immoral? So the how and why of putting things down can be discussed, but ultimately, we can't argue ourselves into letting go. We just have to try it and see what happens, because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense as to why this would be a good thing to do, unless you just want to escape from your life. So the practice of Zazen, or any contemplative practice, really doesn't make any sense. It's outside the realm of sense. So Sawaki Roshi, one of my favorite teachers, a Japanese teacher in the Antaiji lineage, famously insisted Zazen is useless. And we think, of course, this must not be true. I mean, maybe in a sense it's useless. But I would say maybe it's more helpful to say Zazen is the practice of uselessness. When we actually put something down with the same attitude we would have if we were never going to pick it up again. Like, we're just, you know, like that kind of like, if you love something, set it free, right? Set it. It's like you set it free without the like, oh, but I gotta hold on to it. You really set it free and leave it open as to whether it will come back to you. So when we do this, it's like we wake up from a dream. Or we emerge from a state of intoxication. For however long our hand of thought remains open and ungrasping, we draw our breath in a world which needs no justification. The lively reality of this moment does not depend on humanity surviving. It doesn't depend on me surviving. It doesn't depend on you surviving. This moment doesn't depend on certain things lasting. The animal body, which feels pain, reaches for a drink of water, receives an embrace. The heart mind, which brightens at a bird song or clenches at the anticipation of loss. This grounded reality is not dependent on right or wrong. What is left at our moments of completely letting go? Everything. Indescribable intimacy. Ease, like returning home and sitting in peace. A sense we don't have to justify our existence. The value and worthiness of ourselves and our lives don't depend on any measure of worldly success or failure. The value of my life does not depend on me completing any of my projects. By completely putting everything down, we touch the essential aspect of life. So there's the absolute and relative aspects of life. There's different words to refer to the different aspects. But my favorite, absolute and relative is the more typical terms, but my favorite are the essential and the contingent. Contingent, really, to me, it really sums up like the relative world, right? Contingent. It depends, everything depends on everything else. Comparisons, relative things, karma, cause and effect, it's all contingent. So the other side of things, I mean, actually, it might be better to say the other aspect of life is non-contingent. Because even when we say essential, we start to concretize and think of it as something. But it's non-contingent. And they're like two sides of a coin. There are two aspects of our reality. And it ends up being surprising that the non-contingent, when we let go of all that is contingent, it's surprising that life is still so full. So I don't know if I'm getting anything across here, but it reminds me of the lyrics of a Leonard Cohen song that some of you may be familiar with. So Leonard Cohen being a musician, singer, poet, and for many years, he spent many years in a Zen monastery. And this song is from his album that he released when he came out. And I think it's about a moment of awakening. So, I mean, it's kind of crude to just read it instead of his beautiful melody. But so he says, love itself. The light came through the window, straight from the sun above. And so inside my little room, there plunged the rays of love. In the streams of light, I clearly saw the dust you seldom see, out of which the nameless makes a name for one like me. I'll try to say a little more. Love went on and on until it reached an open door. Then love itself was gone. All busy in the sunlight, the flecks did float and dance. And I was tumbled up with them in formless circumstance. Then I came back from where I'd been. My room, it looked the same. But there was nothing left between the nameless and the name. I'll try to say a little more. Love went on and on until it reached an open door. Then love itself was gone. So most of us probably think, how terrible. What could be worse than for love itself to be gone? Love is the best thing about life, right? And this is inexplicable because the essential and contingent aspects of life and how they relate to each other is experiential. It's beyond the realm of the discriminating mind and the language it depends on. But it's not beyond our experience. So we use words like we say, it's like a finger pointing at the moon. I want you to look at the moon. You have to look at the moon. You have to experience the moon. My finger's not the moon, but the finger can, you know, maybe point you toward it. So I'll try to explain a little bit about this poem by Leonard Cohen. So as wonderful as love is, it is still a contingent aspect of life. Love refers to a warm and interdependent relationship among individual beings. Whereas experienced in its essential aspect, life is one seamless whole. It makes no more sense to say, I love you, than for you to declare love for your hand. So there's something even more intimate where love itself has gone. But the essential and the contingent, we must never, ever, ever, well, we will, but we must try to never, ever, ever pit them against one another. They are simultaneous aspects, but if we start to take the calculus from one side and apply it to the other side, we've departed from reality. We've gone nuts and actually are doing harm. So if we say it's most intimate when love itself has gone, that is this essential aspect of our lives. Now, if you take that calculus and you put it over on the contingent side and you say, well, things are most intimate when love itself is gone, when I don't have any love for any of you, like that's horrible. Like that's the opposite of intimacy. So it's a tricky thing. So, but we must recall that our practice, in terms of this putting everything down in order to into touch or take a few breaths in this essential aspect of our lives. We must recall that our practice is not to put everything down and never pick it back up again. It's not a set aside worldly affairs, don't think right and wrong, don't have any preferences, don't make any choices. That's how you should live your life. That's not it, right? That is what we make a practice of doing that. We take time to do that. We make space to do that. We make sure to include that practice in our lives. And then we pick stuff back up. Then we pick back up our activities and our responsibilities and our passions and use our brains and stand for justice and do all these other things. But it's tricky because our dualistic mind wants to identify with one or the other. They can't both be true at the same time. So when we're happily or compulsively engaged in our affairs, we don't want to put them down. When we're feeling overwhelmed and miserable, and we manage to put everything down and at least momentarily return home and sit in peace, we often don't want to pick anything back up again. Some of us have experienced this by going away to retreat, right? Oh, you really literally put everything down and things settle. And then at the end of the, week, you feel so open and still. And it's like, I don't want to go back and pick all that busyness up again. But then we have to go. And I say, like, after the ecstasy, the laundry. So our practice is our daily life. It's precept practice. It's bodhisattva practice. And this is where the true challenge to our self-attachment lies. It's not just the putting down. It's also the picking back up and the putting down and the picking back up. I guess I can end. I hesitate in a way to end with talking about my particular example, my passionate concern about life on this planet and my sense that, we all have a moral obligation to do something about it. I will end by talking about how I practice with this with respect to that. But I don't want this to just be a conversation about that topic or about me and my problems, right? So I want this to be like we all have stuff that we need to put down, and your stuff is different than my stuff. And our willingness or unwillingness to put things down, so I want to keep the topic more general. But just to give you an example of, like, and this is where I feel sometimes like, if I didn't have my practice, no matter how much passion and care I had about life on this planet, I would be full of despair and burnout, and I'd probably be obnoxious and unskillful in my activism. So my practice, essentially the activism is contingent. It's engagement in the contingent aspect of our life. And if I didn't have this other practice, if I didn't have this sense of the essential aspect of life, then it would be very, very difficult. So I feel like practice has a lot to offer, as long as we don't get stuck in one or the other, right? Because that's where I always feel wary. Like, I'm like, I don't want to start talking about how everything's okay anyway. Like, I don't want to start talking about, oh, well, life comes, life goes. It's like, are you kidding me? But that is, there's truth. There's truth to both. So I guess when I, I'm sitting lately, and like I said, I realize, okay, there's a part of me that is just not, there's a bunch of stuff I refuse to put down. Even when I'm sitting, I'm like, holding on to it and working on it. And it helped even just to recognize that that was the issue, right? Because I do have some experience of this. It's like the letting go can be, it has to be experiential. We just have to try it. So it's kind of like dipping your toe into the ocean and then, then going up into your ankles and then going up to your knees and then, and working up to being able to immerse yourself in it. It's, we try it, now what happens? And so when I sit and let go completely, like setting aside my concern about the earth and my sense that we have to do anything about it, like I said, it's like waking up from a dream or waking up from a state of intoxication. Like, oh, that. Yeah, I mean, I guess I already described it throughout the talk, just a sense that this world doesn't need justification, and that this reality, this life, and by life I mean, all life, it doesn't gain its legitimacy from lasting. It will have been an amazing ride no matter what happens. And that is, again, it is not a point of solace that I pit against compassion. But if I didn't have that as well, I don't think I'd be able to cope. So I'll leave it there. Comments and questions. Letting go, completely letting go.
Adomius Joan, you brought to mind something that I found when I watched Go Guogu on his on YouTube. And as far as putting everything down, he sort of helped me with his recommendation. He said, first, you recognize what needs to be done. This needs to be done, that needs to be done, and so on. The second thing is you focus on what can be done at this moment. So say I'm sitting zazen and things come into my head and I need to do this, I need to do that, but what can I do right now? If I'm doing zazen, I can't do it now. So then the third step is to put it on a shelf and get to it later, which coincides with what you mentioned, is pick it up later. But those three steps have helped me when I run into things like that, those kinds of thoughts. And my other comment about your passion for the climate change, I think, don't you think that on the local level you've done your bit, you've done the demonstration and you've raised consciousness about it, that what more can you do? You've done as much as you can do. And I did see on the news that it's a global thing now. The whole world, all the leaders all over the world are having a conference over it. So I see it that you've done your part in raising consciousness, and now the big guns are going to get to it and make the changes to affect that. So that's just my comment.
Thank
Thanks.
you. I love the bit from Gyogu. One of the tips that I have, I can't remember where I heard this, but it is like where you don't just put the issue on a shelf, you put it on your altar, mentally, right? You put it on your altar. And I love that kind of, because then it's an affirmation of like, this is something that I care about. I mean, maybe, and it is something worthy, perhaps. Maybe it's not, like could just be mind wandering, right? But especially the stuff that we're very concerned about, it's like I'm going to put that on my altar for now, so we're putting it aside, but we're still giving it a place of honor. I like that.
It's a great talk, Tomio. I found myself thinking repeatedly throughout it, and yet we cultivate, right? All of that is true, and yet we cultivate. And I get so much use out of the Five Wisdoms framework from Yogacara, and I keep coming back to the analogy of the perfect mirror wisdom that just reflects everything that comes into it. And the way that whether I like it or not, that perfect mirror wisdom kind of already reflects my karmic inheritance. And inevitably we have no choice but to cultivate based on our response to that, right? And I'm losing my own point, but there's a beauty to that, right? Like that we are free and obliged to respond on the ground of our own individuated lives, right? Each of us on the ground of our own perfect mirror, and so we cultivate anyway, which to me is the root of the freedom in the thing.
And you remind me, and I know we've talked about this before, it's intriguing to explore the idea of whatever it is that we are, caught up in. This must happen. I must take care of this. I must change this. I must plan this. I must fix this, whatever. Can we look at it as optional? And of course, like in a relative sense, in a contingent sense, we're like, some things are not optional. Some things are like, life or death, or like, I wouldn't even want to, I wouldn't feel like a moral upright person if I didn't do this thing. But just kind of spiritually, like, what is that shift between we must and I am choosing to, you know, that cultivation, that choice, like, I'm going to choose to do everything I can possibly think of to mitigate climate change, right? I'm going to, like, that's what I'm going to do. And I can do, if, but can I do that as a, even a kind of a joyful choice, as opposed to like, oh my God, like, I'm, you know, which has a completely different tone about it, right? And what I think ultimately is going on is, like, it's not that we're saying things are optional in a contingent way, but as long as we feel that sense of compulsion, there is self-involved. We may think that what we're doing is, you know, very altruistic or on behalf of others or just your basic morality or responsibility, but there's still a sense of self involved. I need to do this thing. I must do this thing. I'm going to succeed at it or I'm going to fail at it. And that's what gives it that extra stress and tension and compulsion. Whereas if we can get the self out of it, ironically, we are just as effective. We are just as loving. We are, and it probably more so. We are probably more creative. We have more energy, more resilience when we get the self out of it. So I'm not saying it's easy. Ruthann, have you been wanting to say something?
Yes. Thank you. This is great. In, I think, August 2019, your friend Tommy spoke at Brightway, and I don't remember which Roshi he quoted, but he said Buddhism is relentless. And I take that notion to how I feel about our limited experience here left on this planet, if we keep going where we're going. So, but I can put that down if my intention is the bigger self, not my, but the just, it's not about me. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, each morning we have the gift of 24 hours in front of us. So that's just what each of us has. And so it's not about us, the outcome. And thank you for this great talk.
Thank you. Bob? Oh. Alice.
Tech issues.
So your talk really resonated with me, because what I've learned is that we all have our own agenda, right? And we all want to do really, really well in our agenda. And especially if you have put a lot of passion, a lot of knowledge, a lot of time, energy,
Your audio's breaking up, Alice. You might want to turn your video off. Can you turn your video off? Oh, bummer. Alice, you're frozen. Can you turn your video off? Oh,
hello. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just in a different room. The Wi-Fi is stronger here.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Please start. Okay. You resonated with the talk, and then we all have our own agendas.
we all have our own agendas, and we really, really want it to happen, especially if like you feel that it's a good, beneficial thing, especially if it's completely important and it's very altruistic and helps a lot of people and you put a lot of energy into it. I think we can all resonate to this, especially the teachers out there and healthcare workers and all that. But like what I've learned is that sometimes we get really, really caught up with that. And then there's almost like a forced energy. Like you're like, I'm going to force this thing to happen. You know, it just has to happen this way. I'm going to force myself. I'm going to force these kids to learn this, or I'm going to force this person to enact this. I'm going to force this person to like change their lives for the better, you know, cause it's better. And what I've learned is that the forcing sometimes doesn't do good for some crazy reason. Like even though our intentions are great, and even though, you know, we're trying to do the right thing or say the right thing, when there's that forced energy, it doesn't happen like naturally. It doesn't happen with good, not even success, but it just doesn't develop. That makes sense. You stiffen up, and there's like a stiffened kind of, you know, to it. And then there's resistance. So, it really resonates with me, because like sometimes you've got to let go in order for that force energy to dissipate.
Yeah, and definitely in relationships with people, right? Nobody wants to be forced to do anything or be judged or whatever. So like whenever we have that, like, you've got to change attitude, it's just like then poof. So I mean I'm imagining many people have this experience of like at some point being able to shift and accept, this person may not change. I'm going to be open to them changing, but they may not change. So now what? And usually like there can be actually some movement in the relationship because of that kind of, we've gotten away from that forcing that you're talking about. And I think it may seem like a jump, but I see this reflected in the precept, do not steal. Honor the gift not yet given, where it's like, at what point when we are making an effort in the world, does it become stealing? You know, we can make an effort to, you know, gain wealth or power or do things. And, you know, at a certain point it's fine, but at what point are we going kind of above and beyond and trying to force something to happen? And it does feel a little bit like it's a relationship to the Tao or whatever, that at a certain point we're pushing and we're not waiting, we're not trusting that the gift is going to come to us or that whatever result it is going to suffice.
Where it particularly resonates to me, it's interesting how you like say that it really links to a precept. I feel like it's linked to sorry to quote, I don't have my book here, but the whole do not praise yourself, do not blame others, because I feel like in our lives, what we do, we have such an intention that like we start counting our successes, you know, almost to the point of like keeping score. Oh, I did this, I did this, I did this. Oh, this person really stopped me from doing that, you know. And then in the keeping score of it is that forced energy. And so sometimes it's best just not to keep score.
I like it. Franklin and then Bob.
Yeah, I like what Alice is talking about. It got me thinking about You know, I think a lot of this comes down to we get hung up on outcomes and stories about, you know, about how things should be or how we want them to be. And I think we lose some flexibility about sort of the game on the ground, so to speak. like we lose track of, you know, when we have a story that we have to live to, then we kind of lose the spontaneity, the ability to be resilient. Hmm. Okay. So, thanks.
Bob.
Hi. Yeah, I want to share something that I think may be a little bit neurotic, but that's okay. You all know me by now. What I'm finding useful is, in order to sort of take my personality out of things, is to view everything as kind of a surprise in a way. Like a thought occurs to me and I'm doing Zazen. In my own mind, I really say to the thought, yes, nice to see you. I appreciate you, but at this time, I think we should all sit in silence and just kind of be friendly to the thought or to the urge that I have without engaging in it in a grabbing sort of way, glomming on. And just say, well, I don't know where you came from, but I appreciate your existence. And so I'll just say hi. And if you don't mind, let's just sit here in silence and practice. And then something else will come along. And it's like, I wasn't really responsible for any of those things that came up. And the feeling that I'm responsible for everything that happens in my mind, I think is a great impediment to practice. And so I find it's very, you don't even have to let go. It becomes the decision of the other thing to let go of you, in a sense, to let go of pounding on you. And I think it works, you know?
Yeah, I like it. It makes me think of sometimes I feel like not just on the cushion, but it's very obvious on the cushion, but everywhere. It's like it's not just me. There's a committee here. There's all kinds of competing interests and proclivities and whatever, which, you know, in Why Buddhism Is True, Robert Wright, you know, they call them modules, right? Little different parts of our brain that have evolved for different purposes. And they're all like chattering away and trying to get the upper hand. And, you know, right now the like meditators, you know, this is my time. But the other ones are like, but what about this? But what about that? And it's like, it does feel what works best for me and what I think is like truest to the principles is not to impose discipline, one part imposing discipline on the others or shutting the others out or something like that, but like a patient talking to the different parts of ourselves, like you were like, hey guys, how about we sit right now? Like, okay, we'll be busy all day, okay? How about, can we have 20 minutes? can we all agree on 20 minutes? And then like, even like what helps me too, because I want to, you know, get everything done. It's like, you know that you're going to be better at getting everything done if you actually put things down for a little while. And it's like, I don't know, you can feel certain parts of yourself relax a little bit and be more willing to participate if you're gentle. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our day. Thank you very much for being here. Say abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Oh, and I forgot to announce, next weekend, I will be in Minnesota visiting family. I may or may not log on, but Thomas Bruner will be giving the talk. So he's always fun. So tune in.
Thanks, Domio. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.